Happy Hanukkah, everyone. Let's start. So tonight, as you can see from the title, the class is From the Eggs of Dodos to the Horns of Aurochs and the Extinction of Species in Jewish Thought. I picked this topic for a few reasons. Number one, I just finished writing up a paper on it, so it's on my mind. Number two, we spoke last week about how Cook's approach of an evolutionary understanding of Torah helps with science-Torah conflicts, and this is going to be an example of that. And number three, can't remember. Those two reasons. Start off talking about the passenger pigeon. Anyone ever heard of a passenger pigeon? Trying to upload a picture of it. It's not working. Let me try once more. Second. Loaded. No, won't do it. All right. Passenger pigeon is a type of pigeon that none of you have ever seen because it became extinct. At one point, though, it was one of the most numerous birds in the world. It lived in North America, and there would be flocks of up to 2 billion birds. 2 billion birds in one flock. They would darken the skies for hours as they flew past. And people shot them, and you could just, you know, fire a shotgun into a flock of passenger pigeons, down dozens. And people raided the nests. People cut down the forests where they like to breed in large groups. And, you know, people just shot them as much as they would kill them as much as they wanted because there was like an endless supply of them. At one point, somebody realized that there were hardly any left, and they quickly enacted some legislation to protect them, but it was too late. In 1917, there was only one left in a zoo. Her name was Martha, and she died. Now, a very tragic example of how of mankind's destructiveness, and how you can think that, wow, there's just so many of this bird, how could any harm possibly come to it, and yet it was wiped out. Right? One of the most numerous birds ever to exist on the face of planet Earth was wiped out in a relatively short amount of time. So, now it's possible to believe in the value of looking after the natural world, even without the notion of extinction. You have this idea that it's important to show respect to God's handiwork and so on. But if you're talking about, you know, encouraging people to be actively involved in conservation and teaching people the importance of active efforts for conservation, that's only really going to be viable if there's a concept that it matters, i.e. there's a concept that things can become extinct. So, okay, well, you might think, well, isn't it obvious that things become extinct? And the answer is no. Up until 200 years ago, there was a widespread belief that not only was extinction impossible with prolific creatures such as passenger pigeons, but even with any animals at all. This was in the wider world and in the Jewish world. Right? It was a universally held belief that species do not become extinct. I remember it when I was in yeshiva in 1992, in Manchester, England. So the mashgiach of the yeshiva gave a shmooze, which he said to all these people speaking about how, you know, we have to save the elephants, we have to save this animal, that animal, you know, it's a waste of time, we don't need to worry about anything, because nothing's going to become extinct. So, you know, I was at the tender age of 17 or 18 then, and I went to him afterwards, and I was like, well, what do you mean? What about the dodo? So he's like, you know, was it just dodo? I explained to him what a dodo is, you know, this large flightless bird that lived on the island of Mauritius. And it only ever was found on that island, and it had no natural enemies, and, you know, they were very quickly wiped out. He said, you know, there must be some dodos somewhere else, hiding in some jungle somewhere. But they were never found anywhere else other than there. And they wouldn't be able to survive anywhere else, so they had any defense mechanisms. I wasn't interested in hearing about it. In the wider world, extinction is now accepted. Actually, Georges Cuvier is normally credited with establishing the fact of extinction at the end of the 18th century. So the question I want to deal with tonight is why is it that the world in general was closed to the possibility of extinction? Which of those reasons are also found amongst Jewish thinkers? And how do we deal with that concept now? Now, as an aside, It may seem that classical Judaism certainly accepted the concept of extinction because You may think that, you know, there's animals described in the Gemara and the Midrash that are said to no longer exist. For example, the Tachash, right, the creature whose skin was used to decorate the Mishkan, and the Shamir, the creature was used to engrave the stones for the Beis HaMikdash, both described as creatures that, you know, they used them for the Mishkan, for the Beis HaMikdash, and then they're no longer around. Doesn't that show that Jewish thought accepts the idea of species extinction? The answer is no, because if you look into the sources discussing the Tachash and the Shamir, they're not considered to have been regular species that gone extinct. Rather, they're considered to be animals that were specifically created for a purpose, and once they fulfilled that purpose, they were hidden away or removed. You know, it's a special creature for a special purpose, which is at a special time, not a regular animal that goes extinct. And there's more to discuss with regard to the identities of those creatures, but we'll leave that aside for now. But, you know, the way it's described, the way the Yerushalmi speaks about the Tachash, it says that God created a sort of kosher wild animal for Moshe in the wilderness, and once the work of the tabernacle had been done with it, it was hidden. Made for that purpose, and once that purpose was used up, there was no longer reason for it to be around. And the Shamir, it said that it was created on the eve of the first Shabbos of creation. Five that was created, you know, along with other things in that list, for a specific purpose in history. Okay, so why is it that people did not accept the possibility that animals go extinct? Chesky points out that with the Tachash, it says it was hidden away, not that it became extinct. Right? Even with the Tachash, something that was specifically created for a purpose, you might think, well, it's okay for it to go extinct, but even then, it doesn't say it became extinct, it says it became hidden away. Good point. Okay. I'm just making a note on its note here. That point. Chesky? I've also got to take notes in my class. Okay. So why is it that in general people do not believe that species go extinct? So let's go back to the 18th century, which was really the turning point. Well, one of the people who's most famous for arguing that nothing goes extinct is Thomas Jefferson, the president of the United States. I'm not American. He was a president, right? I think it was the second or third. The Americans on this list? Yeah, we have a bunch of Americans in class here. Third president, right? One of the founding fathers? Yeah. Third president, one of the founding fathers. Never knew anything about him before a few weeks ago, but I've been learning about him. He was quite brilliant. A genius in many different areas of science and culture. In fact, I read an interesting story that JFK once invited like 42 Nobel Prize winners to the White House for a meal. He announced to them that there hasn't been such a collection of brains and talent sitting in the White House since Thomas Jefferson dined alone. Right? He was brilliant, very knowledgeable in many areas. He was one of the areas he specialized in was paleontology. And you know, the 18th century was really a time when there were lots of fossils being dug up. And Jefferson insisted that all these creatures, they must still exist in unexplored regions of the world. That all these creatures must be living somewhere. And what was his reason? His reason was that the wondrous nature of the natural order and its apparent zeal for maintaining itself, you know, indicates that it's been set up in such a way as to rule out extinction. So let's see what quote here from Jefferson. And the movements of nature are in a never-ending circle. The animal species, which has once been put into a train of motion, is still probably moving in that train. If one link in nature's chain might be lost, another and another might be lost, till this whole system of things should vanish by piecemeal. A conclusion not warranted by the local disappearance of one or two species of animals, and opposed by the thousands and thousands of instances of the renovating power constantly exercised by nature for the reproduction of all her subjects, animal, vegetable, and mineral. He says the fact that in one part of the world you can't find a species anymore, so that's not an indication that it's extinct, because you know, when you look around in nature in general, you see how everything is constantly trying to reproduce and maintain itself. So that tells you that is what nature's about. Nature is all about maintaining itself. So the fact that you can't find a species in one place would not indicate that it's nowhere to be found. Then in another of his works, Jefferson listed all the mammals of America. He wanted to document the mammals of America. And in this list, he put in the mammoth. Right? The mammoth is the giant hairy elephant. And he's aware that he was aware that some people were going to start challenging him. You know, because remember, this is the time when there was a debate about extinction. He was aware that people were going to challenge him about listing the mammals amongst the wildlife of America. So he says as follows. It may be asked, why I insert the mammoth as if it still existed? I ask in return, why should I omit it as if it did not exist? Such is the economy of nature that no instance can be produced of her having permitted any one race of her animals to become extinct, of her having formed any link in a great work so weak as to be broken. Grant to this the traditional testimony of the Indians that this animal still exists in the northern and western parts of America would be adding the light of a taper to that of the meridian sun. The poetic style of writing. Okay, I'm not sure what you're saying there in that comment. Maybe you can elaborate. So Jefferson was so determined to prove that these allegedly extinct species still survived that one of the reasons why he sent Lewis and Clark on their famous expedition was to find living mammoths and mastodons. Right? He wanted to show that they were still out there, and that's what Lewis and Clark were looking for. And obviously, they failed to find any. By the way, if you ever want to see mammoths, great place to see them is in the La Brea tar pits in L.A. Right? They have these pits of tar where animals walked in and got stuck, and you can see you can see there's still the open pits of tar, and you can also see like lumps of tar they've removed with all the bones preserved in them, as well as mounted skeletons. Okay, so Jefferson is saying that the natural world is set up in such a way, you know, it's such a wondrous system that how can you say it's got any deficiencies? Now Rambam, that's in the non-Jewish world. Now Rambam, a long time earlier, said a very similar thing. Rambam says, paste it into the window here. In the Moron of Uchim. Shlomo himself has stated that these works of God, the universe, and all that is contained in it, remain with their properties forever, although they have been created. For he says, whatever God does, it shall be forever, nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken away from it. He declares in these words that the world has been created by God and remains forever. He adds the reason for it by saying, nothing can be added to it, nor nothing taken away from it. But this is the reason for the perpetuity, as if he meant to say that things are changed in order to supply that which is wanting, but in order to take away what is superfluous. The works of God are absolutely perfect, fitting no addition or deduction, must remain the same forever. It is impossible that anything should exist that could cause a change in it. Alright, so here's the idea, that there's an idea that God created a perfect world, and if he created a perfect world, it means that no new species can come into existence, and no existing species can be lost. Right, so the new species to come into existence means that it was missing before then. It means that creation was deficient. The species to go extinct means that it's superfluous. So, according to Rambam, the idea that God created a perfect world, it's not possible for species to come into existence or for species to disappear. Okay? Now, we do have to remember that Rambam was very much influenced by Aristotle. And in Aristotle's model of a static, you can definitely see Aristotle's model of a static universe in here. But it's not just, you know, rationalists like Rambam. Okay, so Adam is saying things can be necessary at one time and not at another. Yep, it's a good point. Now, it was not just somebody like Rambam who says this. We also have a similar idea in the Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch was published in 13th century Spain. Nobody has any idea who wrote it. Look at what the Sefer HaChinuch says. And this is talking about the Sefer HaChinuch, right? It's a book of mitzvot, and one of the commandments is you're not allowed to castrate any animal. We not castrate any species, neither man, animal, nor bird. But the roots of this commandment are that God created his world with ultimate perfection, neither lacking anything, nor possessing anything superfluous to anything that is needed for its perfection. And it was from his will to bless animals to reproduce, and he also commanded He also commanded the males of the human species regarding this, such that they should perpetuate. But otherwise, the species will become extinct after death overtakes them. Therefore, someone who ruins the organ of reproduction, seed, demonstrates himself to be as one who disdains the work of the Creator and wishes to destroy his good world. So there you see the idea that, that the world doesn't have anything missing or superfluous. And therefore, species don't go extinct, and And the inference is that part of the perfection of creation is that creatures are endowed with the ability to survive forever. Later we'll see something even more explicit in the Sefer HaChinuch regarding extinction. Okay, so that's Rambam, Sefer HaChinuch. Question here? Now, we have a similar idea in Ramban on the verse, the Alakim Kito, of God saw that it was good. So Ramban says, the survival of species forever. What was good? You know, God saw it was good that species should always exist. Okay, so they have three Rishonim representing Rambam, in a fairly broad spectrum there, all saying that species will always exist. Now, moving much later in time to Ramchal, Rabbi Chaim Luzzatto, right, in the 18th century Italy, so he doesn't directly discuss extinction per se, but he does say something that suggests a very similar idea. He says, one who looks at the components of creation according to their superficial appearance will at first see nothing other than scattered and disparate parts. That is to say, they are not connected to a single purpose, but rather everyone is distinct for a special purpose. But one who goes deeper in wisdom will find that all parts of creation are tied together with a proper knot, as they are all required to complete the concept that the higher wisdom intended the creation, and they all united in a single purpose. Right? Now, you might say that, here's a good basis for conservation. Right? Ramchal's preempting the 20th century concept of the ecosystem. But it's more than that. He's indicating that species can't become extinct because God decreed a certain goal for creation, and God's plan is not going to be messed up. So all creatures play a role in God's plan. So this idea that all species are a part of of God's plan for the universe would apply to everything, right? And that would be based on the Midrash and the Gemara, say as follows. Midrash first of all. Even things which appear to you to be superfluous in the world, such as flies, fleas, and mosquitoes, are also part of the creation of the world, and God performs His operations through the agency of all of them, even through a snake, mosquito, or frog. And the Gemara says, of everything that the Holy One created in His world, He did not create anything in vain. He created the snail as a cure for scabs, the flies an antidote for hornet stings, the mosquito as an antidote for snake bites, snakes as a cure for sores, and spiders as an antidote for the stings of scorpions. That's the idea that God, everything serves a purpose. It's all part of the perfection of God's creation, and therefore nothing can go extinct. I see the comments that everyone's writing here. Patience. We're gonna. I'm not saying that extinction is compatible with Judaism. I'm just showing you explain why these authorities saw it that way. Okay? So this line of reasoning that rules out extinction is pretty straightforward. Right? It's the idea that, number one, God created a perfect world. He wouldn't allow this perfect world to become damaged. Every species contributes towards this perfection. Therefore, nothing can become extinct. Okay? So that's a dominant reason in both the non-Jewish world, and in the Jewish world, why nothing can become extinct. Right? Again, it's the idea. So first one is perfection. Right? The world is perfect. Each species contributes to that. And therefore, nothing can go extinct. Okay? That's the first reason why extinction was thought to be impossible. Okay. Someone... If you have any questions, let's just see what the questions are here. Nope. Okay. Fine. Let's go to reason two. The great chain of being. There. Right. Adam says, in the non-Jewish scientific world, there's a concept that when a species goes extinct, it messes up the system. Right. It's the idea of the ecosystem. But the point is here, in the ancient, up until the 18th century, the concept was that the system could not be messed up, right? That God would not allow the system to be messed up. That God set up the system in such a way that it will not be messed up. So that's one of the reasons why Thomas Jefferson and many others insisted that it's not possible for species to go extinct, right? And that's what Rambam, Sefer HaChinuch, and Ramchal are saying. It's just, here, Ramban, let's put his name. Ramban, Sefer HaChinuch. People raising the issue of free will. Okay, so we'll get to that later, but I guess as far as these authorities were concerned, free will wasn't going to interfere with God's plan. And that God has a certain goal of the universe, and part of God's perfection of creation is that he wouldn't let that be messed up. Okay, now we get to a concept called the Great Chain of Being. I don't know if any of you have heard of it. It's now way out of fashion. But throughout the entire classical and medieval period, The Great Chain of Being was kind of like a concept which was used in so many ways. It was just basically a fundamental concept in how people viewed the world. The idea being that there's a chain, a hierarchy, from the lowest being form of existence in the world all the way up to God. In other words, all the way through from the lowest animal, through the animal kingdom, to God, it's a chain. It's a linear chain. And nowadays, we visualize the animal kingdom kind of like, you know, a bush. Branching bush, you know, the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom and all these bushes. But the Great Chain of Being idea was it's not a bush, it's a linear chain, like a ladder. And everything has a place on that ladder. Right? There's a neat pattern, everything. So, for this reason, I mean, this was the reason why there's a German philosopher, Gottfried Leibniz. He held that species extinction was impossible because you have to have the Great Chain of Being. In other words, the chain has to be complete. Okay, I see in the comments here people are suggesting how to involve extinction. Yeah, again, we're going to get to that, but I'm just discussing now what the classical medieval authorities said why extinction is impossible. So the idea of the Great Chain, again, that the chain has to be complete. That God created a chain, and there can't be any discontinuous leaps. It has to be a smooth progression from the lowest thing in the natural world all the way up to God. And every stage, everything on that chain has to be present. Again, I'm having trouble uploading pictures today, but if you do a Google search for Great Chain of Being, you'll see some beautiful ancient drawings illustrating this idea. And Alexander Pope, who was a poet in the 18th century, here's a poem which expresses the idea of why the Great Chain of Being means that nothing is ever going to go extinct. Yeah, let's look at this. Vast chain of being which from God began, nature's ethereal, human, angel, man, beast, bird, fish, insect, what no eye can see, no glass can reach, from infinite to thee, from thee to nothing, on superior powers, were we to press inferior might than ours. Or in the full creation leave a void, where, one step broken, the great scale's destroyed. Nature's chain, whatever link you strike, tenth or ten thousandth, makes the chain alike. Wow, I think that's the first poem I've recited since high school. One person in the class here actually was in high school with me. Okay. So here's the poem. Now, the key is in the last two lines. Right? From nature's chain, whatever link you strike, tenth or ten thousandth, breaks the chain alike. Idea being that when you have a chain, even if you just damage one link of that chain, it doesn't make a difference where the link is, the chain is broken. The entire chain is broken. You only need to break one link for the entire chain to be broken. So if the idea is that the universe is set up in such a way that there's a chain, like there's a smooth hierarchy from everything in the natural world, through the lowest elements in the animal kingdom, you know, then through the spiritual being, through the God. So every step in the chain always has to be present. There can't be any link of the chain missing. So that was another reason why there's extinction. Another reason why there can't be extinction. Right, this is slightly different from the first reason. Even though we saw Thomas Jefferson, actually, if you remember, he also made mention of the chain of being. There's a slightly different nuance. Right, the first idea is the idea that just in general, nature, the world is created in a perfect way, and that perfection can't be harmed. The second idea is a more specific idea that it's not just stamped that every creature is necessary, but every creature has a place in this chain, in this linear chain, and every stage in that chain has to always be filled. So what about in the Jewish world? So there's something we found in Malbim, right, the Meir Leibowitz ben Yechiel Michel, the 19th century. He's known by his acronym Malbin. And he has an interesting idea, which I came across years ago. At the time, I'd never heard of the Great Chain of Being, so at the time I thought he was talking about something to do with evolution. But then after I read a book about the Great Chain of Being, I realized that this is what's going on here. Creation progressed from level to level, inanimate matter, plants, animals, and man. Everything that came earlier was a preparation for that which came later. After God established the luminaries, without which life could not survive, he gave instructions for the creation of animal life. It is known that also in rising up through the ladder of stages, creation did not proceed in discontinuous leaps, but rather through intermediate stages. Thus, coral is intermediate between inanimate matter and plants, polyps are intermediate between plants and animals, and monkeys are intermediate between animals and man. Similarly, every level rose in an order of lower to higher, as we have written with the formation of plant life, where it rose from herbage to grasses to trees. So too did it proceed with the formation of animal life. Right, so years ago when I saw this, I thought maybe that's kind of some kind of support for evolution. But really he's not. He's not talking about evolution at all. As we're going to see later, Malbin separately expresses the idea that nothing becomes extinct. So he definitely didn't hold to the concept of evolution. What he's describing here is the great chain of life. The idea that there is, a linear progression throughout the entire natural world. Now, Chesky's asking, does this view of the great chain imply an infinite number of species? It doesn't imply an infinite number, but it does imply, it's also known as the principle of plenitude. It does imply that every space is filled. Right? Not an infinite number, but that every space is filled. That there's not going to be any discontinuities. Like what Malbin says, creations do not proceed in discontinuous leaps. Right? You're going to work out some linear hierarchical system in which every space is filled. You know, and originally, when people started working classification systems, so this was one model, the model that people tried to do. Right? And there was a whole model of the natural world now, which you have, you know, orders and classes and families and genera, which is always modeled, you know, as a bush, like a family tree, modeled as a tree. But people used to think that you're going to be able to model it linearly. Now we realize now that it's just not possible. You can't map the natural world that way. Intermediate steps between Domin Sinai Chaim and Dabra surely precedes Malbin. I haven't been able to find anything earlier. I haven't found an earlier source. If someone else can find an earlier source, I'd be fascinated to see it. So here, you know, Malbin doesn't explicitly relate this idea of the great chain of being to the impossibility of extinction. But elsewhere, he does clearly rule out extinction. So his idea of the great chain of being may have tied into this. Let's look at what Malbin writes elsewhere about extinction. Paste it on the screen. Yeah. It's in the pasuk. For generation upon generation, you establish the earth with your faithfulness. Even with regard... excuse me. Even with regard to the earth, which does not exist forever, the offspring of the land exist and die, as is alluded to with the words for generation upon generation, which is a period of divisions between old and new generations. Nevertheless, there you have established your faithfulness, which is the assurance that species will not become extinct. Just as it states, making fruit according to its kind, every living creature according to its kind, be fruitful and multiply, that he commanded that they should be fruitful and multiply, and that species should remain in existence. By way of this faithfulness, you establish the earth and it endures. Right, so Malbin clearly ruled out extinction. We'll see other sources from Malbin later. And it's interesting, you know, he too mentions the idea of the great chain of being, which is another dominant factor in people considering extinction is impossible. Okay, so the great chain of being, we have the Malbin. Now we get on to the third reason, perhaps the most basic reason, why it was thought that species do not go extinct. Anyone want to guess what it is? One word. Type it into the box. One word as to why people, the basic reason why people thought species do not go extinct. Begins with a P. No one's guessing? Providence. Hashkacha. There's a basic idea that God looks after everything in the world. God's care. In other words, we're not talking about the idea of a perfect creation. We're talking about God's interaction with the world. God looks after things. And this is really implicit in the whole story of Noah's Ark. Like, why does Noah need to take the animals in the Ark? Let all the animals be wiped out, and God will make new ones. Now, we can come up with all kinds of different answers for that, but I think one straightforward idea is that because God takes care of species, and if animals are going to be wiped out, he's going to make sure, he's going to look after each species and make sure that representatives remain. And really, the whole book of Eov, right? What's the book of Eov? Eov has this tremendous suffering, and eventually he cries out to God and says, you know, God doesn't seem to care about me. And God's answer goes through all these different things in the animal kingdom and speaks about, you know, the great care that God has for the animal kingdom. Right? He looked after the young ravens and the snakes, right, and the behemoths and all these different creatures. Right? The idea that from big to small, God looks after every creature. So Eov, how can you think that God is not, you know, ignoring you? He's not ignoring you. There must be some kind of purpose, because you see that God cares about everything in the world. God looks after everything in the world. And this is something that the Malbim draws out in his commentary to Eov. Go here. Providence. God made known how his special providence extends upon all his creations, whether with regard to the creation of existence in its entirety, or with regard to each individual creation. He cares for the needs of everything, to enable it to find sustenance and shelter, and to care for the survival of the species, whether with regard to its birth or the sustenance of its young, and all the more so does this providence extend upon man, the most choice of creations. And then if we look at how some of Shonim explains certain mitzvahs, we again see this idea that providence is linked to the idea that species don't become extinct. Okay, the mitzvah Shiloh HaKein, right, which is two aspects to the mitzvah. One is that when you come across a bird's nest, you're not allowed to take both mother and young. And when you take the young, you have to send the mother bird away first. So let's deal first with we're going to deal here with a negative aspect of prohibition, that you're not allowed to take both mother and young. Look at Ramban and Rabbeinu Bachai, it says. They say that this commandment is also similar to Osev Yesbanai. If and its young, you shall not slaughter in the same day. The reason with both of them is that we should not have a cruel heart that does not have compassion. Alternately, Scripture does not permit us to engage in destruction, to uproot a species, even though it did allow the slaughter of animals of that species. If one kills a mother and young in one day, or takes them both together when they could have flown away, it is as though he's exterminating that species. What are they saying? They're saying that killing both mother and young is equivalent to exterminating a species. Now, how is killing, you know, a mother sparrow and her baby equivalent to killing a species? The answer is that it's conceptually the same, because when you're killing the mother and young, you're showing you don't care about the perpetuation of the species. And showing that you don't care about the perpetuation of the species is equivalent to bringing about its annihilation. So that also presumably would work the other way around, that allowing the annihilation of the species means that you don't care about its continuation. Right? And God certainly cares, right? All these psukim speaking about how God cares, so presumably that would mean that he wouldn't allow these species to become extinct. Now, there's an important point to mention here. According to many opinions, there's a difference between providence for people and providence for animals. Is that providence for human beings functions on an individual level, whereas providence for animals functions for the species. Right? So therefore, it would seem that now, but how does providence for species differ from providence for animals? So you might think that, well, look, with providence for individuals, individual humans, obviously it doesn't mean that the person lives forever, right? Nobody lives forever. So if providence for individuals doesn't mean that individuals live forever, then why would providence for species mean that species live forever? Right? So let's look at, that would seem to be a basic difference between how providence for species and providence for individuals would function. Ramchal says, here's why this difference is really illusory. Providence for individuals means that the individual is looked after until it reaches the end of its his or her allotted time in this world. And the same is true for species. The species is looked after until it reaches the end of its allotted time in the world. But the difference is that the species, its time in the world is forever. And this is how it links back really to the idea of perfection. That it's part of the plan for the universe that there should be all these species. So So the allotted time for species is forever. So there's not really any difference between providence for species and providence for individuals. In both cases, providence means that you're around for the time you're supposed to be around. For an individual human being, that's 120 years. For a species, that's forever. Now you have an even more explicit idea that providence relates to species not going extinct in Sefer HaChinuch. We mentioned Sefer HaChinuch earlier, the concept of perfection, but here he mentions it again in the context of providence. Okay, so this is Sefer HaChinuch in the Mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein. It says, one must send away the mother bird from the nest before taking the young. As it says, you shall send away the mother and take the young for yourself. Among the roots of this commandment is that we should internalize that God's providence is upon all of his creatures, amongst the human race with individuals, and with other types of animals with the species as a whole. That is to say, the desire of God is for the survival of the species, and therefore no species shall ever become extinct from all the species of creatures. For through the providence of the living and eternal upon something, it finds its survival. And when a person gives thought to this, he understands the ways of God, and he realizes that the continued existence of species in this world, that not one of them, from the eggs of lice to the horns of Ra'amim, has ever become extinct, the day that all were created, by his word and desire for it. And likewise, a person comes to know that if he observes the commandments of his Creator, and is straight in all his ways, and is innocent and pure-hearted, God's providence will be upon him, and his body will live long in this world, and his soul in the next world. Okay, so here you say very explicitly, no species shall ever become extinct. From the eggs of lice to the horns of Ra'amim, nothing can be extinct. Why? Because of the providence of God. God's care for things. And this is actually what my Rebbe in Yeshiva in Manchester told me in 1992 as to why all these conservationists are wasting their time, because God's providence ensures that nothing will ever go extinct. And this is really, you know, a bedrock of people's faith. And this was especially true. Now, this is something, again, that was an idea found in the non-Jewish world and also in the Jewish world, especially for Jews, who they never took their survival for granted. So, you know, it's clear that almost like a religious worldview would develop a view of God's benevolent providence that wouldn't allow for a species to become extinct. God cares. God looks after everything in the world. Okay? So here you have the third reason as to why it was said that the extinction is impossible. Now, someone asked, does anyone explicitly link this Ramban to the impossibility of extinction? No one's ever discussed this before. As far as I know, I'm the first person to research extinction in Jewish sources. No one ever discussed it because it was never really a big issue. Well, it was just, you know, unthinkable till the 18th century. Even after the 18th century, nobody in the Jewish world, nobody ever really started arguing about it explicitly. Well, as we see, there were some implicit people discussing it. Okay, so by the end of the 18th century, it gradually became undeniable that some species could clearly become extinct. You know, dinosaurs. Right? There were all these discoveries of dinosaurs and mammoths, things like that. And, you know, you couldn't find them. And it became increasingly difficult to say that they're hiding away in some remote part of the world because the world was becoming ever more and more explored. Right? You have maps, people have been everywhere, Australia everywhere. And it became very unlikely to say that all the dinosaurs were hiding somewhere. So how is this going to be reconciled with all the aforementioned theological beliefs that extinction becomes impossible? So the Netziv, colleagues for Yehuda Berlin, he implicitly addresses this. He just speaks about extinction of dinosaurs. He says that dinosaurs were not naturally occurring creatures, but rather dinosaurs came about as the result of sinful crossbreeding experiments by the generation of the flood. Actually, I remember now, I first heard this back in 1992, after I asked my Rebbe in Yeshiva about dodos, and he said they were hiding in the jungle, I thought about dinosaurs. He said dinosaurs aren't natural animals. Yehuda HaMavel made them in crossbreeding experiments. Right? Obviously, it's scientifically untenable. I guess if, you know, in his time, maybe it didn't appear that way. But he could say it. We cannot. We know it's now scientifically untenable. But what's going on? Why is the Netziv saying this? Why is he saying that dinosaurs were not naturally occurring creatures? The implicit background to this comment of his is that he's addressing the question of how could it be that they became extinct? We have God created a perfect world. God takes care of everything in the world. How can it be that these dinosaurs went extinct? That's the unstated question that Netziv is dealing with. And the answer is that they're not naturally occurring creatures. They're not part of God's creation. Right? They're man's Frankenstein's monster. And it's man's corrupt creations. Obviously, that's a bit of an odd view. Now, in general, in the wider world, the way at the beginning of the 19th century, the way people got around this issue of extinction of dinosaurs and the way they reconciled it with their theological views was to draw a distinction between the idea of there being different eras in the creation of the world. The idea being that God created the universe in stages, and each stage he catastrophically destroyed and replaced with a more perfect stage. It's a model you find in the non-Jewish world. A model you find in the Jewish world too. Most famously would be Yisrael Lifshitz, Tiferes Yisrael, right? Where he has a famous essay called Drosha Arachaim, printed at the back of certain editions of the Mishnah, except those editions that it's been torn out of, where he goes into great detail describing dinosaurs and mammoths and all that stuff. Running out of time here, let's speed up a bit. As regards the past, Rabbi Avraham states at the beginning of Bereishis Rabbah that the words when it was evening and it was morning indicate there were a series of epochs before then. The Holy One created the world and destroyed them, approving some and not others. The Kabbalists expanded upon this statement and revealed that this process is repeated seven times, each sabbatical cycle achieving greater perfection than the last. We are unable to appreciate to the full the wonderful accuracy of our Holy Torah when we see that this secret doctrine, handed down by word of mouth for so long, revealed to us by the sages of the Kabbalah many centuries ago, has been borne out in the clearest possible way by the science of our generation. The questing spirit of man, probing and delving in the recesses of the earth, in the Pyrenees, the Carpathians, the Rocky Mountains of America, and the Himalayas, found them to be formed of mighty layers of rock lying upon one another in amazing and chaotic formations, explicable only in terms of revolutionary transformations of the earth's surface. Probing still further below the earth's surface, geologists have found four distinct layers of rock, and between the layers fossilized remains of creatures. Those in the lower layers are of monstrous size and structure, while those in the higher layers are progressively smaller in size, but incomparably more refined in structure and form. Furthermore, they found in Siberia in 1807, under the eternal ice of those regions, a monstrous type of elephant, some three or four times larger than those found today. Similarly, fossilized remains of sea creatures found within the recesses of the highest mountains. One natural scientist, Cuvier, has calculated that of every 78 species found in the Earth, 48 are no longer found in our present epoch. All this we can see, that all that the Kabbalists have told us for so many years about the repeated destruction and renewal of the earth has found clear confirmation in our time. Again, he's not explicitly addressing the theological issues of extinction. It's more like he's grappling with just what are these fossils all about. But his approach is the same that the people in the non-Jewish world were adopting at that same time when they were addressing these issues. They're saying that all these species that became extinct were from previous eras. They were catastrophically destroyed in acts of God, in creating a new and better world. That was a way of making these ideas of extinctions theologically acceptable. Very insightful comment from Stanley Kaplan here in the chat box. Okay. So the first reconciliation is the idea of prior worlds. Now, it gradually became clear that not only had extinction occurred in previous eras of the world, but even in human history. So what was the first species in modern history that was recognized to have gone extinct? Does anyone know? Dodo. Dodo, correct. The dodo, right? The large, flightless bird and Mauritius. Right? That's where they lived. They didn't have any predators. They were very trusting. They could fly, so people could kill them very easily. And people introduced pigs and rats and monkeys to the island, which raided their nests for eggs. And within a century of their discovery, there were no dodos left. So found it very interesting. You know, Google Books, so they scanned in like millions and millions of stuff. Unbelievable what you can find in Google Books. So I found this 19th century magazine. It has an article on the extinction of the dodo. And it prefaces it with a disclaimer from the editor as follows. We are aware that the destruction or total extinction of any of the species of animals of contemporaneous creation with man is a point of much controversy among philosophers. The best reply to this doubt is the repeated discovery of the fossil remains of animals entirely different from the existing species expecting their extinction to form a part of the scheme of creative wisdom. Two very important points to note here. Firstly, you see how it mentions contemporaneous creation with man. It's controversial to say that creatures in our era become extinct. To say that creatures from the previous era became extinct, that's already been accepted, the idea of there being previous worlds, previous stages of God's creation. The idea that something goes extinct in our era is controversial. The magazine says, but look, it's true, it's undeniable. We found all these fossils and there's nothing like them alive on Earth. But you know, it sweetens it theologically, says proving their extinction to form a part of the scheme of creative wisdom. He's saying that the extinction of the species is also part of providence. Now, in this article itself, there's a reference to a paper by John Thompson. He was a naturalist back in the 19th century. He went to Mauritius to surf with dodos. And in 1829, he published his article saying about how there's no dodos left. And he says as follows. The dodos are the only vertebrated animals, right, also backbones, which we can make certain of having lost since the creation. We seek to find out what link in the chain of nature has been broken by the loss of this species, right? See, addressing the great chain of being thing, what others have lost their check, and what others necessarily followed the loss of those animals which alone contributed to their support. I think we may conclude that the first extinction being seen by an omniscient creator, at least no injury will be sustained by the rest of creation. That man, its destroyer, was probably intended to supplant it as a check, and that the only other animals which this destruction drew with it were the intestinal worms and pediculi peculiar to the species. So, you know, he's concluding his scientific report with a theological reconciliation. But it's providentially arranged that the dodo, that we have to broaden our understanding of the chain of nature, the great chain of being, and we see that it's not some crucial link. It's to be designed to be replaced by man. The only things that died along with it were its own particular intestinal worms. But it doesn't affect the rest of nature. Interestingly, this, even with the dodo itself, it's not clear if this is true, because there's a certain type of tree. There's actually a bit of discussion about this in science. There's a certain type of tree that's becoming extinct in Mauritius, and it's thought that the reason is that this tree's way of propagating was only via dodos eating the seeds and then excreting them. And there are certain seeds of certain trees that can only propagate when they pass through digestive tracts of certain animals. Right? There are certain trees that can only propagate if elephants eat their fruit. So there's a certain tree which is argued it's becoming extinct because there's no dodos around to process the seeds. But anyway, the point here that's being said here is that extinction, the way of accepting extinction was to, without it harming the perfection of creation and the idea of God's providence, was to make it part of God's providence. Part of the perfection of creation, part of God's plan. Right? That God's plan is that certain species are gradually being replaced. But, you know, if extinction is widespread, right, and if there's lots of creatures going extinct, then what are all these creatures being replaced by? So I guess you could say, well, they're being replaced by man, who's becoming more populous. But it also, I think the implication is that what are all these species being replaced by? Other species. So you've got the idea here of evolution. Right? So basically what we're talking about is a radical overhaul of your understanding of the nature of God's creation. Right? The classical medieval understanding of the perfection of God's creation was a static view. Right? That there's a perfect universe with all the species that you need, and that perfection is how it has to be for all time. Therefore nothing can go extinct, nothing new can come into existence. Right? No extinction, no evolution. But now we have to completely overhaul the model and realize that the perfection of creation is in a dynamic model. Right? It's an ongoing process, an evolutionary process. And this is something you'll find in Rav Kook. Here we go. Rav Kook writes as follows. The evolutionary way of thinking, so popular as a result of recent scientific studies, has caused considerable upheaval among many people whose thought had been wont to run in certain regular, well-defined paths. Not so, however, for the select hard-thinking few who have always seen a gradual evolutionary development in the world's most intimate spiritual essence. For them, it is not difficult to apply by analogy the same principle to the physical development of the visible world. Evolution itself, moving upwards coordinately and undeviatingly from the lowest to the highest, demonstrates most clearly a prevision from afar, a preset purpose for all existence. Divine greatness is thereby enhanced and all the goals of faith confirmed, and trust in the service of the divine is all the more justified. all strives upwards, and man has it in his power to improve and perfect himself and his world. He is manifestly thereby doing the will of his creator. Spiritual perfection is thus seen to be in the center of all existence. He's not discussing extinction per se here, again, but he's showing how, you know, a whole worldview. No, this is not my translation. I can't remember where I got it from. I think I got it from Challenge. Showing how the whole worldview of Judaism has to be, you know, have to realize what it really is. And this isn't apologetics. You know, Judaism is really different from other ancient religions in this way. Ancient religions always had the idea of everything being cyclical. There's never any really progression. Everything's always cyclical. But Judaism always had this idea of progression. And this is what Cook is saying. That we see this idea of progression. And when you apply that idea back to life on Earth, it would be the idea that life evolves. Certain things become extinct. They get replaced by more fit, right, more advanced species. So, you know, with the medieval Jewish understanding of the perfect world, extinction wasn't possible. You need to have a Cook's transformation in order to understand this idea that species can become extinct as part of the natural order. Right, so it's with Cook's model of evolution as being part of the natural, part of the order of things, that you can understand evolution in the animal kingdom. Right? This was what I wanted to mention. So, you know, last week we mentioned the idea about how Rav Cook has an evolutionary understanding of the intellect, or understanding of Torah. And here you see how he's making it like a basic principle that applies also to the natural world. Adam says, Judaism is about progression. So many base so much on the descent of the generations. That's true. So many do. But I would say that there's different models you'll see in Judaism. There's some people who stress the idea of descent, and there's some people who stress the idea of progress, and there's some people who try and have some kind of blend of the two. I have to say, many contemporary evolutionists will not say that evolution is about progression. They'll say it's just about diversification, but not the idea of progression. But I don't think it's too difficult to see the idea in evolution. I mean, we're certainly more advanced than any species that's existed until now, in terms of, you know, the brain is the most complex organ in the known universe. Okay, so this all goes to explain extinction as part of the natural order. But what about extinction resulting from people? And as what Cook said so far explains how part of God's perfection in the world is not a static perfection, it's a process of perfection. It's a process of the natural world becoming ever more advanced. But what about evolution? What about extinction resulting from man's destruction? And that is the primary cause of extinction. In other words, the vast majority of species that have gone extinct in the last million years, or at least 10,000 years, have gone extinct in the last 100 years, right? Because of habitat destruction, hunting, and so on. So that indicates that man has the power to harm the perfection of God's creation and the ongoing process of perfection. So that in itself could indicate a deficiency in God's creation. That doesn't make it idiot-proof. He didn't make it damage resistant. So how are we to reconcile that with Judaism? And the answer is that's really not so difficult, because you have a Midrash all about that. Right, Midrash says as follows: Look at the work of God, for who can rectify that which he has damaged? At the time when God created Adam, he took him around the trees of the Garden of Eden, and he said to him, "Look at my works, how beautiful and praiseworthy they are. Everything that I created, I did it for you. Take care that you do not damage and destroy my world, for if you damage it, there is no one to repair it afterwards." Right, so all those previous mentioned authorities who had an issue with the idea of creatures becoming naturally extinct, yeah, because that would be the idea that God didn't make his world the right way. But the idea that man could harm God's plan, yes, sure. Because part of God's creation is to give man free will and responsibility. And responsibility means consequences. Yes, we can damage the world that God has created. So nobody would ever have... Yes, God creates a perfect world. God providentially cares for things. But God gives man the power and the responsibility to damage that world. And he trusts us with the task of healing it and repairing it. Now outside of this, my experience in the yeshiva back in 1992, you're not going to find many people who are aware of all these views of these Rishonim and Acharonim that extinction is impossible. But I think that nevertheless, the general idea on which it's based is something you will find in Orthodoxy. Right? This idea that God created the world, God's looking after it, and it can't really come to any harm. Now, there's a huge debate over global warming, like climate change. And you'll find in the Orthodox world, many people say that the whole thing is a scam. No such thing as climate change. Now, why do they say that? So, I've been discussing this a lot on my website, my Rationalist Futurist website. For sure, a lot of it, on both sides of the equation, there's both the people who say there is global warming, the people who deny it, a lot of it has to do with political affiliations, Democrat or Republican. But a lot of it is to do with that. But there's also an aspect that I've seen that a lot of people who are in the Orthodox world who deny global warming, it's the idea that God's looking after things. If God creates the world, he knows what he's doing. How could it be that man can harm it? That's basically the same ideology, a similar ideology which led many of these Rishonim and Acharonim to say that species don't go extinct. But we have to remember that, no, the Midrash said things do go extinct. Species have become extinct. And it's within man's power to do that. What I think is especially ironic is if we go back to the Sefer HaChinuch, what the Sefer HaChinuch said about providence. Go back to the Sefer HaChinuch. Hold on a second. Let's go back and look at the Sefer HaChinuch. Right, Sefer HaChinuch says that nothing's ever going to become extinct. What example does he give? Nothing in the animal kingdom, from the eggs of lice to the horns of Ra'amim. Now, what's a Ra'am? Ra'am is an aurochs. Right? It's a huge, huge, like, cow-like thing. Actually, the ancestor of domestic cattle. Right? They're the most powerful animals in the world of Tanakh. And therefore, they represent the upper extreme of God's all-powerful abilities to sustain the world. Right? God not only cares for the teeniest, tiniest creatures, the lice and their eggs, but he even looks after he's even powerful enough to maintain the perpetual existence of the largest creature, even up to the aurochs. The problem is, aurochs went extinct in 1627. They were hunted to extinction. So, you know, from the eggs of dodos to the horns of aurochs, species have become extinct. And accepting the reality of that requires us to modify the traditional understanding of creation. Right? We have to replace the idea of creation as a static model with the idea of it a dynamic model and the perfection and its striving towards perfection. We have to accept the idea that God has given man the choice and the ability to harm this plant. Only if you need to make that transition using Cook's model, and that's how conservation becomes a Jewish value. Any questions? Okay. Nice quote on the Great Chain of Being from Ambrose Bierce. Now, that's the circle of life he's talking about, not the Great Chain of Being. Stanley wants to know, am I going to talk about current Haredi thinking in this subject and how they reconcile previous thought? There is no current Haredi thinking in this subject. I mean, no one talks about this. It's not really an issue. Okay, I have an obscure interest in things, but I've not been able to find anyone else discussing it. Well, I'll tell you what happened, 20 years ago when I was looking into an yeshiva, I came up with a suggestion that maybe when the Sefer HaChinuch says that no min ever becomes extinct, min isn't exactly a species, min is a broader classification system. Right? Min is like a family, so no family of animal species becomes extinct. But that's clearly not true either. There's been many minim that have also become extinct. Glyptodons. I don't think this issue has ever really been addressed. But, this morning, Sammy, the point you made earlier was very good, right? You said that you can see why certain people are afraid of me. Once you see the flaws of the methodology of our sages in this regard, it casts doubt on the methodology and all other regards. Right, slippery slope. Once you apply critical thinking to the, this is not to the, what our revered Rishonim and Acharonim have said, so obviously that goes strongly against the whole traditionalist approach. Right? You don't critically analyze the words of Rishonim and Acharonim. You accept them, but you don't critically analyze them. So ask your local rabbi, would he acknowledge that there are extinct animals? I don't know. I don't know him. Now, a lot of people who aren't willing to say that Chazal are mistaken in science, but nevertheless, they are willing to say it about Rishonim. Obviously, you're not going to find people, a lot of people discussing this because exactly the concern that Stanley raised, because it's something that you know, it shows them to have had wrong ideas about certain things, and especially because the only way to really get the right idea is to adopt Cook's model and to adopt evolution. Extinction and evolution are inextricably linked. The idea that there's dynamic change, and obviously evolution is a no-no for many people. How certain am I that the aim is the aurochs? The other possibility is the oryx. It's not extinct. Nearly went extinct. It's not. I discussed it in my book, which is more likely. Does that mean there's no consensus in Jewish thought as to whether extinction or not? Well, consensus what? Across the ages? Correct. There's no consensus across the ages. Well, I'm sure there was a consensus 500 years ago that there was no such thing. Adam wants me to discuss Leviathan. I have a chapter on it in Sacred Monsters. I don't think I'm going to do that. What will I talk about next week? I haven't decided. The topics I'm thinking of doing are either giants and dwarfs or a general discussion of the differences between rationalist and mystic Judaism, which is a very important class. How many lectures have we done so far? It's our sixth, right? So we have, I think, two left. Right, so we have two left. So, okay, so maybe next week I'll do rationalist Judaism, and maybe in the final week I'll do a whole discussion about the ban in my books. Yeah, I think that's what I'll do. I think it's a series of eight classes. I'll find out if there can be more, but as far as I know, it's only set to be a series of eight. If you want more, maybe write to Torah and Motion and ask them if they want to arrange some more.